It's over here is John Linnell from They Might Be Giants over on stage. Well, I used to be on stage right, and I'm sorry, I used to be on stage left, and now I'm on stage right.
I don't know whether to be sad, happy, devastated, amazed, but this is a historical thing.
Well, I mean, I think it's maybe not as ground-shattering a thing as you're suggesting, but I think it was a really a good move for us just now. And part of the reason for it was that we started changing the show in this particular way, which is the drummer has his regular drum kit, but he also has this electronic drum kit, which we were doing shows that were exclusively him on the electronic drums, me playing electronic keyboards, and John doing various instruments as a three-piece. So we thought we'd do a sort of a version of that in our live show with Marty crossing the stage and walking to the electronic drums. So the idea is, like, it's two drum sets on either side of the stage. I'm now kind of mostly front and center, although sort of shifted a little bit to the right. And the two guitars are now stage left, and the bass player is behind me. And so it's all, you know, it's disorienting in a good way for us. You know, I think we feel like we're giving ourselves a fresh start on the live show. And there's a lot of surprises in the show, too, a lot of new stuff and certainly new material.
What you did is you know, the two Johns turned around and said, okay, we're forming this band, we want to have fun, and we're just going to throw a lot of things in the pot and see what sticks, right?
I think that's a pretty good way of putting it. It wasn't that we had some vision about how the future, you know, way of promoting. And in some ways, I mean, I think some of the ways that we came up with to promote what we were doing early on were not necessarily for everybody. They were kind of conversation pieces. They were not necessarily practical things for any band, you know. I mean, Dial-A-Song being kind of the main example. I think that most bands probably felt like that wouldn't be a good way to present their material anyway. So aside from it being a conversation piece for them, it maybe wouldn't communicate what they were doing effectively. And we sort of felt like, well, we could take advantage of the incredibly narrow bandwidth of the telephone line, sort of use that, you know, in a way, have that be an aspect of the experience, you know. And also just the idea of picking up the phone and listening to music seemed, at that time, 1983 or whenever it was, you know, it was this novelty. It was kind of fun, and people responded to it.
Boy, did they, because you went through 8 gazillion answering machines.
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, we've pretty much gone through our last machine as of, you know, a while back, actually. They've all pretty much have gone to the answering machine lodge in the sky. And we also maybe at this point feel like it's been, the experience has sort of been overlaps enough with contemporary ways of listening to what we're doing, you know, at home without leaving your house, maybe it's not as cutting edge as it was, you know, 20 years ago. So we've kind of let it quietly die, more or less, but there's still plenty of ways, obviously, to check us out, you know, if you don't want to leave your house.
But what's interesting, and I didn't even think of this until you brought this up, is now, again, as a New Yorker, there's still, if you were to take, say, San Francisco and New York, or L.A. and New York, there's still a preponderance of people who still have answering machines in New York. There's still a lot of people that have stuck with answering machines versus the, you know, the digital stuff.
The voicemail, yeah, I guess that's right. I mean, I think that the days of the standalone machine those are gone, and I suspect even the standalone machines are mostly gone, and people just buy $20 or $10 phones that just include an electronic chip that does that job. And then, of course, a lot of people, even if they have landlines, they just have some voicemail system. So yeah, I mean, I'm saying this like I'm you know, I'm probably the same age as you. Right. It's you know, in some ways, it's pertinent to us because we started out doing this with a, you know, with the culture in a certain place, and sometimes I think we forget that the culture really has shifted completely. You know, I think that the weird thing, the difference between the cultural shift that's taken place in our lifetime and the previous generations is that it wasn't very abrupt. It was, in our case, it was very gradual. And the other thing is that we were sort of the dominant culture. You know what I mean? Like the baby boom crowd managed to kind of hold on to, managed to control the culture sort of for longer and more effectively than, you know, when our parents were middle-aged, all of a sudden it was like the culture was grabbed from them wholesale by the younger generation. So it was a very different experience, and I think we were even kind of expecting that that's the way it should happen, you know. So it's very, you know, I guess maybe just to, I'm getting a little bit broad in talking about this, but I think that John and I didn't really know what to expect when we started doing this. You know, we didn't know what we were supposed to be doing or who we were talking to exactly, and so we just never quite defined it for ourselves, and as a result, in a way, we have never really nailed it down even to this day.
Well, let's see, the demographic is this to this, so we should aim for this and this and this.
You know, we were unaware of who the audience was even in the 80s for what we were doing. I mean, I think, and if we, I think if we tried to guess, we would have guessed wrong, you know. Because it certainly wasn't, it turned out it wasn't the MTV viewership, you know, that sort of everyone was told, oh, this is who is consuming music now. And, you know, we did actually have videos on MTV, but I think we kind of stuck out like a sore thumb at that time, that we were not exactly what was prevalent at that time. And it wasn't until we were being played on college radio that we found out that there was college radio, which was seemed like an actually much more suitable place for us to live.
When I listen to Hey DJ, or I listen to Puppets, at whatever I listen to, but it's more about, I think, what you represent is that when you started, you were youthful, you're continuing to do this, and it's more about keeping kind of, you know, that music doesn't have to be dead serious to be political or interesting, right?
Yeah, that's why I think that we didn't completely plan it, decide what it was, you know, what our philosophy was. We didn't articulate it to ourselves, but I think that's perfectly right, that we thought humor was a part of what we did, and we didn't want to censor that out just because it was uncool or something like that. You know, I think it probably closed some doors for us along the way at a certain point, but it was so much of who we were that it's the reason why we're still doing this, is that we kind of didn't try and second guess the audience and decide like, oh, well, this is okay, this isn't allowed, you know. I mean, on some level, I think we maybe do have those ideas of what's okay and what's not allowed, but they're much more personal than, you know, what does anyone else think is cool.
The other thing that people spend a lot of, like, I'll say, well, I'm going to see, you know, They Might Be Giants tonight, right? And there's this, it's I call it the chasm. It's like, you know, it's the Hudson River meets the East River in one big river that meets the Nile. And it's the over here, oh, wait, I think I've heard of them. Are they that intellectual band that does the weird stuff? You know, versus over here, which is, dude, can you get me a ticket? Because it's sold out. And that must be, again, back to the, you know, your place in this world and not planning it. People try so hard to categorize everything. And I think when we're talking about our culture, right? When you were a kid and your mom made, you know, honey, we're having steak and potatoes for dinner. You didn't say, now, is that going to be a fillet? Is that going to be a round? Or is that going to be the blah, blah, blah? You just said, cool, what time's dinner, right?
I think that people have an intuitive grasp of what they like about us, and they're not necessarily explaining it to one another, you know. I mean, I think that's really the value, in a way, of what we're doing to us. And I hope that's, you know, that's the dynamic for the crowd, is that we're not it's not necessary to explain it, to like it, or to understand it. You know, I mean, I think people can just like it, and that's generally a thing about popular culture, is that you don't need an explanation for everything. You can just, I mean, for us, in a way, maybe it's reached this sort of critical mass where the fact that just that people have heard of us means somebody in the room can say, oh yeah, I like them, without having to make sense out of it or explain what it is. I think that people do have explanations, which I doubt that we strictly go along with, but if that's a way to get into it, that's fine, you know.
No was interesting because it was kind of a mix of all different things to me that would appeal to kids. But when you get into science, I don't know about you, you're probably going to be the polar opposite of me. I didn't make it past biology.
We were not brilliant students in school, right? I mean, I think that we have set ourselves up by making a science album as kind of, you know, I think people get the misimpression that we're claiming expertise. The truth is that when we've done interviews about science, we're usually talking to people who know way more than we do. Like, you know, Ira Flatow or somebody, you know, somebody who's got a science, you know, angle on their show is the one who's going to ask the science questions. So it's pretty clear who's who in that interview. And we reminded ourselves frequently when we were making this project that we are the entertainers, and we are, the point is not to like list every fact and have it all exactly arranged, but to actually make it sort of interesting. And if we had to, you know, sacrifice content to make it entertaining and fun, then that was probably a good idea.
My twist on Darwinism, mm-hmm. you know, my brother the ape, mm-hmm. that's also what's really fun, is it starts out a certain way. And what makes it wonderfully childish is that suddenly you go, oh, wait a minute.
Well, it's a song that does not, it starts out where the protagonist in the song is not necessarily buying the whole theory of evolution. And so it's a song, you know, it's not my position on evolution, but it's somebody who is, I think it's, you know, it's a way of talking about that idea that you know, we're informed that every living thing on the planet has a common ancestor. And so it's slightly like the position of the song is like it's slightly freaked out at the thought that like your cousin is asparagus, you know, and it just doesn't, it's not intuitively true. And that's an interesting thing about science, is that so much of what's true is so counterintuitive that you have to kind of walk away from your intuition in those situations. You know, it's a funny song because it's about sort of a family reunion.
Kate has a question, and it's really funny because this was the demographic test of the album that she's. There's a song on this album that I have now heard about 40.
What made you decide to redo Davy Crockett?
Well, it was a decision that came down actually from Disney. And I can't remember what project this was for, but they wanted us to do an updated version of the original Davy Crockett song. And since we were doing a science thing, we thought, well, you know, put him in outer space. But I mean, the other thing about it is that I don't know whether this caught your attention, Kate, but or whether are you familiar with the original version?
No.
Because John and I were upset by all of this sort of Indian fighting and Indian killing imagery in the original, and we were really racking our brains to figure out how to cover this song, you know, when we felt like it seemed like it was glorifying this pretty dark chapter in American history, you know, where the Indians got wiped out by the white people. So we pretty much just walked away from that one and cooked up a whole new lyric for it, and Disney seemed pretty happy with that, so everybody was okay with it in the end.